that destroyed Debbie Harry's solo career. I own that record. There was nothing good on it.
Cuckoo,
yeah.
No, but it's a great album cover. It's a great H.R. Giger.
Yeah, it is H.R. Giger, and it's a great album cover. But I have not seen that since, what year was that, 84, 85? Blondie had just done their biggest bomb record. I think it was The Hunter. It was right after Auto American. And then this was her first solo record. And I don't know what she was thinking. I think she just felt she was untouchable. And it just, yeah, they were never the same. Anyway, I'm Brett Easton Ellis, and I'm in Frederick Stronger's apartment, and I'm the author of The Shards, which has just recently been published here in Stockholm, and I have no idea what I'm here for.
You're actually here.
I am here. I am present. But this is my first interview or discussion of the day, and so I never look at my itinerary. I don't do it, because if I look at my itinerary, I'm not going to get out of bed.
You were kind enough to invite me to your apartment on 13th Street in New York almost exactly 25 years ago, right before Glamorama came out. I did an interview with you, and I remember it because it was around Halloween, and there was still confetti in the streets, kind of like in the book, where it gets inexplicably cold and it rains confetti the whole time.
Yes, that's right.
And reality turns into a TV set. So
yes.
It was as if the book was
mirroring reality.
So I thought I'd just return the favor and invite you to my home. I'm so very happy to have you here.
So strange how much time has passed, how many things have happened to both you and me.
I was 25 then. I'm 50 now.
And I was about 34 or 35.
Yes, and you were complaining about how you didn't like to spend time in front of the mirror anymore.
Oh, well, that's
gotten... Because you felt so incredibly old.
That's gotten a lot worse. Well, that's also a gay thing. So when men are in their 30s and they're gay, they're already aged out of the sexual possibilities in ways that straight men are not. No, I remember, and it's happened this year very clearly. I remember when I was young, teenager, and I would see my father, my grandfather out by the pool or on the beach, and I would say, I'm never going to have a body like that. I will never have a body like that, and I will never present my body like that. Well, I walked out of the shower the other day, and I said, oh my God, I have my father's body now. I have my grandfather's body now. How did this happen? I guess it happens to everybody. So time passes. It just passes, and we accept it, and we're all on the list, and, you know. But I can't believe I was complaining about the way I looked in my mid-30s, because I look at pictures now of myself then and think, God, you were really so much better looking than you thought. You really just had so much self-abnegation, and you were so, like, sort of down on yourself, which I think is pretty typical, again, for gay men who live in large urban centers.
Well, youth is wasted on the young, they say.
It is.
This is the 157th episode of this podcast, and it's the first time ever that I have a guest who is not a musician, but you did actually play the keyboards.
I am a musician.
You are a musician,
I've been
yes.
in three bands. I've written hundreds of pop songs. No, I am a musician, and I am a songwriter. So, no, but professionally, that is true. Professionally, never happened.
You were in a band called The Parents. That's
at Bennington College, yeah.
Great band name.
It is a great band. And why didn't anybody else take it? We never made a record. I mean, and we had some great songs, but yeah, no one ever took that name as the name of their own band.
What did you sound like?
Well, during that time, this was roughly 84, 85, we were going for that kind of Minneapolis sound. The Replacements were a big influence then, and so that is the band that we were trying to sound like, but with an even poppier edge to it. We wanted to go beyond Tim and get closer to Please to Meet Me. It was kind of, even though that record hadn't come out yet, but we wanted to sound like The Replacements.
You haven't been to Sweden for 32 years.
That's not true.
I actually checked that.
2005, no?
If you were here in 2005 and I missed it, you know, I would have committed suicide. So I don't think you were here.
So it was not, I was here for Glamorama. Yes, I was, definitely.
No way.
I was here when the Nobel Prize was given out. I was at the Nobel Prize ceremonies for literature in either 05 or
really?
2000. Yeah, 99.
How could I miss that? That's insane.
Yeah, no, I was here.
I thought about that when I reread Lunar Park, where the Brett Ellis in the book mentions that he bought a Suzuki motorbike with, and I quote, unexpected Swedish royalties. Do you remember why he wrote that those royalties were unexpected?
Because royalties often are.
Oh.
Book royalties are often unexpected. Sometimes you are surprised that you actually even get royalties, because most of the time you don't. Most books don't earn out their advances. I know your listeners probably don't want to go into the business part of publishing, but you're given an advance, you have to earn the advance back, and then you get royalties. And 90% of books don't earn their advances back. So royalties are rare. You asked me, or my publisher asked me through you, to give you 6 or 7 songs.
Yes.
Look, I just threw them out there. They're all from the Shards. They're all connected to what I'm... these are not my favorite songs. These are just songs that in that moment, I just dashed off, texted to her, you have them now, and I am... this was 24 hours ago, and now I don't even remember what they were. So forgive me if I'm a little bit rusty. This is Dreaming by Blondie, and it really is the final moment of The Shards. It's the final... If The Shards was a movie, this would be the song that would blast over the credits.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Shards is set in 1981, which was an excellent year in music. You know, if I had to pick one single year...
Oh, my God.
I only listen to that year for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
1981 would be probably my choice.
I agree. 1981, more than 82. I'm also a 70s guy, so I think 78 was pretty good. But I would agree with you. 81 was the pivotal music year for me. The year that music mattered the most.
For some reason, I also really like 1971 with T-Rex and Hunky Dory by Bowie. And also 1991 and even 2001. There's something about the ones.
There's also something about 1979 as well, which is when Dreaming was released off Eat to the Beat. But 1979 had some amazing records. It had Fear of Music by Talking Heads. It had Tusk by Fleetwood Mac. It had Armed Forces by Elvis Costello. I mean, 1979 was also a great year.
When you wrote American Psycho, you did a lot of research on Wall Street.
Yes.
And on men's fashion.
Yes.
Then when you wrote Glamorama, you sort of dove into 19th celebrity culture.
Yes.
How much did you have to research this time? Did you have old diaries?
Nothing. Memory. Sheer emotion. Sheer memory and emotion. A couple journals. I couldn't find the original outline for this book that I started in 1982. I didn't know where that is. I have no idea where that went. It's lost. I put aside Less Than Zero to write this book in 1982. And for all of these years, it's just been eluding me. It never found me until a couple years ago it did. So there was no research to be done. The only research that I needed done is I needed to find out about the Sherman Oaks Galleria and how it was set up in terms of the second floor. There's a scene in the book, a pivotal scene in the book, where one boy is mysteriously chasing after another boy through the Galleria. And really, the only way I could find out was because nothing was curated. And go to the internet. There are not 1,000 pictures of the Galleria, which was in America in 1981-82, the hot spot for teenage life. The red hot center, the zone for teenage life in America was the Sherman Oaks Galleria. There are no pictures of it anywhere on the internet. You have to watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the credit sequence, and then that's what I did in order to remember the sequence of the stores.
But
no research.
At that time, back in 1982, when you started the project, did the story include a serial killer at that point?
Totally. That was a huge part of it. It was an even bigger part of it than it ended up being now, because serial killers were ubiquitous in Southern California at the time. There were 10 to 20 of them roaming the hills
like
and the
Night
canyons.
Like
the
Night Stalker, people like that?
The Sunset Killer, the Hillside Strangler. The Night Stalker was a little bit later on. But the city was still wounded by the Manson murders, and they were just all over the place. And so if I was going to write a novel that was set in Southern California in 1981, it had to have a big serial killer. So the serial killer, the trawler, was always in this book. The Dickies, I'm stuck in a Toyota with Trisha Toyota. I'm stuck in a pagoda. No, I'm stuck in a Toyota with Trisha Toyota. That's the name of the song.
Who was Trisha Toyota?
Trisha Toyota was an Asian newscaster who was very pretty, who was very big in L.A. on NBC Channel 4 nighttime news. And a lot of guys had crushes on her. She was very exotic, and she had this very kind of unusually pretty oriental otherworldliness. And so the Dickies wrote a song about her, and this is really, I was a fan of the Dickies because I had a crush on one of its members. They never had a song this good, and none of their other records sound as pop as this.
I thought a pagoda was a car at first, but it turns out that it's one of those Asian towers.
A temple, yes.
Yeah.
It's
I saw you last night at Revol, the theater.
So you know all my answers.
I was a little surprised when you mentioned that the lack of parental control in your high school years was a good thing. Because a lot of people might read your books about young people and go, but where are the parents?
That's the wrong way to read my books. That has nothing to do with the problems at hand. Nothing to do. We live in different worlds now, different generations, different parenting skills. I mean, my God, when I look at the parenting skills of my parents' parents, my grandparents, it's all different. Every generation seems to have a way of dealing with their children that is different from the one before. Well, I did not particularly look at the pain of my life, whatever trauma I had was connected with parents that weren't there. And none of my generation did either. That was not a central problem. Now, to this generation, it seems to be like, oh my God, it's the reason why Gen X is so fucked up or whatever. We're not so fucked up, and it had nothing to do. It was freedom. We had freedom. We had freedom. That's what was so important. I did not miss my father because I only saw him on weekends, and I was so happy my mom let me go out and play until whenever I wanted to, and they couldn't track me with a phone. I could do whatever I wanted.
Did you naming your band The Parents have anything to do with that?
I suppose there was some sort of irony to it.
You grew up in Sherman Oaks.
Yes.
In the Valley, and you went to the Buckley School, where the Shards take place, of course. Many famous people have been students there.
Yes.
A lot of famous people's children.
Yes.
I think you went to school with Christian Brando. And Michael Landon Jr. was there.
Landon Jr. was in my class, and I knew him quite well, yes.
Also, Paris Jackson went there, and of course, two massive reality TV stars, Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian.
Well, way after.
But yeah. I can't help thinking that maybe they were inspired by the motto of the school, Dare to be True. So they made reality TV.
I did not even know that was the motto of Buckley. I don't know if it was the motto when I was there. Maybe that motto emerged after I graduated. I don't remember that. Or else I would have put that in the Shards. That would have been great to be in the Shards.
It's all about, you know, what is true and not. Dare to be true.
Dare to be true. I love it.
Because, I when reading the book, it's a lot about you hiding your sexual feelings.
Yes.
And, you know, if that was the motto of the school...
Oh, God,
maybe you
would
have thought,
great.
Well, maybe I should dare it to be true.
You know what? It also might have been too on the nose. It might have been a detail that would be too symbolic. The metaphor might have been just too much, too ironic. But also, I could have played with it. I love that.
One of the funniest parts of the book is how Brett, the main character, fails to be super attracted to his girlfriend, which makes him even more attractive in her eyes in some ways because he's so hard to get. She can have anyone, and he's not that interested.
Yes, this is true. This is the irony of my relationship with my girlfriend in my senior year that I wanted to write about. She was the hottest girl in school. Any guy could have had her. For some reason, she liked me, and I was secretly gay, and I went along with it anyway because I wanted to fit in. I wanted to fit in. It was 1981. And I wanted to fit in, and I kind of wanted to experience what this kind of popularity was, because I wasn't popular. I was popular by association with her and her friends.
Other guys must have felt like, how does this guy get to go out with her?
They told me, what's I almost said her real name. No, believe me, I had friends who had huge crushes on her and just couldn't believe that I was dating her.
But have you?
And they were jealous.
Have you been in touch over the years, you and Debbie?
I have not. Was not in touch with her for decades and decades and decades until this January when the book was finally published, and I got a message from her on Facebook saying, "Of all the names that you had to use, I hate Debbie the most." And then we went out to dinner. We hadn't seen each other in over 35, 40 years, and we went and had dinner together, and it was kind of rough emotionally because I did not really know. And of course, the person who's not in love and doesn't have the same feelings as someone who is in love, you know, it's different emotions. I finally felt her pain. We had dinner. She was really in love with me. And it was just a bad choice on her part. A bad choice. But we all make bad choices. I made a ton of them. So we all pay the price. Unrequited love. Well, the next song is Vienna by Ultravox. It plays a huge part in the book. I think it was the only song that I had to pay the rights for. And if the book sold a certain amount of copies, then I had to pay even more rights for. But it was worth it. It was a song that was very popular when we were in high school. And it was an odd song to be such a big song because it was long, 5 minutes. It was very slow. It was very, very minimal. It didn't sound like anything else from 1980. And I don't know. There was something about it. It had this sort of kind of soaring, minimal romanticism that we all connected to. And also there was an abstraction about it. You could put anything you want, any feelings you wanted onto that song because, like the best pop songs, it's an abstraction. It can mean anything to anybody.
And the chorus echoes through the book. It means nothing to me.
Which, of course, is not true at all because that's ironic because it means everything to him. It means everything to him, so he uses it ironically throughout the book.
You've mentioned a lot of times how difficult or even painful it was to write the chapters about music in American Psycho, where Patrick Bateman expresses his love for very commercial artists like Phil Collins, Whitney Houston, and Huey Lewis and the News. The music in the charts seems to be closer to your own taste. Was that a relief? Or?
Look, I love writing. American Psycho was a blast to write. It was really, really fun. I laughed my ass off for 3 years writing about Patrick Bateman, and I was a little frightened by how dangerous the book got. But there was a month where I wrote about those music chapters: Phil Collins, Whitney Houston, Huey Lewis, and the News. That was a pain in the ass. That was purely technical. It had to be there. I wanted those three reviews there, but that was the only time in my life where I found writing not to be fun. And that was not my musical taste. My musical taste in 1987, 88 was The Replacements and bands like that. So it was a tough thing to attempt. Now, it is true, I have written books with a lot of music in it. There's a lot of music in Less Than Zero that I like. There's a lot of music in The Rules of Attraction, which is mid-80s. That has a great soundtrack. So does Glamorama, but you are correct. This is the closest I've ever come to being so autobiographical, writing about myself in so many ways in this novel, and really referencing the songs that were playing. In some of these scenes that really happened, that song was playing, and I remember it so well. You're at that age when you're so porous and open to experience and music, and I listen to everything. I can tell you with a certainty that is completely unwavering what song was playing, what day, what scene, what party, before what movie. It's just burned into my senses.
When American Psycho came out, I was sort of an industrial goth, and I laughed so hard at those chapters about Phil Collins and Whitney Houston. Then as I grew older, I kind of warmed up to a few of those artists. I even danced to Genesis' Invisible Touch at a party last year.
Not only I've warmed up to some Genesis, I've warmed up to some solo Phil Collins, which really surprises me. I love that song that he won the Oscar for from Tarzan. What's it called?
You'll be inside of me.
You'll be in my heart. You'll be in my heart?
They made fun of it on South Park, where it was, you'll be inside of me or something.
It is fantastic. It is fantastic. It is Phil Collins' towering moment. I would never have thought that he'd been in a band with Peter Gabriel, but there you go. Looking out a dirty old window, down below the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why. Kids in America by Kim Wilde is the next song, and it plays also a pivotal role in The Shards. There's a scene where Brett is watching the video of Kids in America, and he locates in it this numbness he's searching for from Kim Wilde's blank face while she's singing this anthem, this soaring anthem, but her face is deadened. Doesn't really move. She's not smiling. She's not like wide-eyed at the soaring chorus. She's just staring there dead-eyed. And it was so powerful to me. It was what I was searching for the moment.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And Brett in the book watches this video in a nightclub because MTV hasn't started yet, right?
Yeah, it wasn't even a nightclub. It was just a space, a warehouse space on a deserted part of Melrose in Hollywood, which had not been gentrified yet. And it was very, very cool. And it just consisted of about six rooms, this flat gray carpeting, very low lighting, and in each room they were playing new videos by artists like Joe Jackson, Tommy Two-Tone, whoever it was, and Tim Curry, I Do the Rock. And so you would just go from room to room with your drinks. There was a bar and you'd watch these new videos. And I always for 40 years wanted to write about my first night there. And so I finally got to do it in The Shards.
And Kids in America is such an anthem. It's really a song about joy and being so excited. And she doesn't seem that excited. You write that she was offering an invitation, but she didn't care if you came or not because she could always find somebody else. Do you think that numbness was typical to early 80s music? Or
I think there was something about punk and new wave that influenced a lot of people. And I do think that it became apparent in the music that was being made. I think the most striking example is Fleetwood Mac with Tusk, which was produced by Lindsey Buckingham, the group's guitarist, and he kind of overtook the production. And he was so influenced by the minimalism of New Wave and the Talking Heads that he took this sort of like very lush Southern California mid-70s rock sound and kind of pared it down into what almost sounded like a New Wave record. And so I saw this happening kind of a lot in music, or I was locating it, and... So what was the question again?
If that sort of numbness was around before the 80s.
It was in the air. It was a kind of spareness, a minimalism. Whether I keep referencing the cover of the Talking Heads' Fear of Music record, which just seemed so shocking to me because it was just this kind of black thing with raised little bumps on it and then the title stamped on the top of it, the Fleetwood Mac album cover of Tusk, which was all this terrazzo with the word Tusk in tiny letters on it. There was just this feeling of pulling back, of being minimal, and that was cool. It was cool. It was an antidote to the 70s. It was something that was streamlined, direct. Patrick Nagel prints, you know, just this way of looking at the world that was very different from the lushness, the bigness of the 70s, which was then being, considered tacky. So there was a stripped-down thing that I was really... influenced by, and Less Than Zero is an artifact of that.
A later artist who's not stripped down, but has some kind of numbness to her, is Lana Del Rey. How do you feel about her?
I feel that Lana Del Rey is one of the best artists of our generation, and I love most everything she's done. I especially like the stuff that she's been doing with Jack Antonoff. I think he's been a great collaborator with her. And I think has Mariner's Apartment Complex, is that what it's called? I forgot what it's called, is my favorite song of hers. That was off Norman fucking Rockwell, the third track on that. And so I love that song. And I love that record. I thought that was her best record. I was supposed to interview her on my podcast for the record that was coming, the last record, which I thought was great too. And then that didn't work out and things kind of soured. I don't know why. But Lana Del Rey has a very lush Southern California sound. And I don't know. So yeah, I like Lana Del Rey.
You seem to share some kind of interest in how America has developed from its imperial face.
Yeah, it's imperial face.
Which you've written a lot about. You even coined that term, I think, in your article about empire and post-empire America.
Yeah, I know. I should have done a lot more with it. I wrote one or two things about how we had moved from the empire of post-World War II, where we were really the most powerful country in the world, and then moved into a kind of post-empire after 9/11 and the election of Obama. And things really radically were changing, especially with the invention of the interweb. The interweb, people.
Like Lana Del Rey, you've also been attacked by feminists, and you both share some kind of interest in the loss of innocence. I have this conspiracy theory that I can't let go of. Lana Del Rey was born in June 1985, the month that Less Than Zero was released. And I can't help myself but thinking that maybe you went to a party in late 1984 and kind of went home with an account manager from an ad agency in New York.
And then I'm Lana
nine months
Del Rey's
later,
father.
She... Yes, but her mother never told you.
I can assure you that did not happen.
Okay, I'll just...
I can assure you. I'd love to take credit for being Lana Del Rey's father, but I can assure you in 1985, that did not happen. I did not go home with anybody from that party.
Okay, I'll just drop that theory.
No way, girl. You're living in a dream. No way, girl. You stay behind the scenes.
is what I thought was an incredibly obscure track by B-Movie. It's called Nowhere Girl, and I think it's from 1981 when I first heard it. It's a piano-driven, kind of propulsive new wave song, minor key, and it plays throughout the book. It haunts Brett, and it's also tied into his feelings about the murders of these young girls that are happening around the San Fernando Valley. But there's something stopping me from getting.
I only know of B-Movie because they were on a compilation called Some Bizarre, which was the record where Depeche Mode had their very first song released officially, called Photographic. So that's the reason I know of B-Movie. I haven't listened to them.
I could not believe when The Shards was released how many people loved Nowhere Girl and loved B-Movie. They never had another hit. They were a one-hit wonder, but this song was such a part of my soundtrack when I was 17. It is. It really plays throughout the book, and I guess it was a lot more popular than I thought. People have a fondness for it that I was not aware of.
There's a chapter in your nonfiction book White where you write about the first time that you realize that some people are unable to enjoy a good pop song unless it lives up to their political ideas. You're in a car with a friend and the Bangles' Manic Monday comes on the radio.
Yes.
And what happened then?
My friend, who was super smart, super funny, this girl that I was really, just really close with, I said, oh, I love this song. The Bangles' new record, Different Light, is great. The Bangles were going for commercial success. They had a lo-fi album that had done okay, but they wanted to move into the majors. So they made a very commercial record. Prince wrote the song Manic Monday. And my friend, who loved the early Bangles, hated this new glammed up, overproduced Bangles. And she also really didn't like Susanna Hoff's, what she called, baby doll vocals. And she thought they were selling something that she never thought that this all-female band was going to sell. Themselves, their image, their sexiness. They're singing this song like, oh, I don't know what to wear at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I just don't. And then she was just so annoyed by that. And then I told her, a man wrote this song. She said, of course a man wrote this song. That's the problem. And it was like, it was so ridiculous to me, our argument, because it gave me pleasure. Manic Monday gives you pleasure. And if you can't get pleasure from Manic Monday, then I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do with yourself then. But she just, there was something about it that bothered her. You have to understand, this was in the early of 1986. We had this conversation, I believe it was February or March of 1986. And she just didn't like the way the Bangles had become, I think, sex objects.
The lyrics are so beautiful. That whole, I was kissing Valentino by a crystal blue Italian stream.
Fantastic.
It's, you know,
It's not ideological. She turned it into something ideological. And it really is a feminist statement because it's about a woman who has a no good boyfriend who doesn't have a job, and she's supporting him. She's going out. It's another Manic Monday, another work week. I got to go out. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to get out of bed. And she's going to get the money to support them. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's a great pop song, and she was in a moment. I don't know. She was just in a moment where she could not locate the sonic, the aural pleasure of it. And instead, what bothered me so much was it was the first stirrings of people looking at things from an ideological place instead of just experiencing them on a pure pleasure surface level.
And that thing kind of exploded in the 2000s, I guess.
Yeah, it did.
It's funny how...
It's still around.
It's funny how the Bangles somehow got connected to you thanks to the movie version of Less Than Zero, which opens with the Bangles version of Hazy Shade of Winter. And, you know, even though that movie might not be very good, that's a pretty pretty good opening, I think.
It's a great opening.
It's a, you know, it's a fantastic song.
It's a fantastic song by Paul Simon, and it's such a better production than the original. Really, a great cover of that song. I am actually quite fond of the movie now. It has aged incredibly well. It has nothing to do with the book, and it has no scenes from the book. It has no dialogue from the book. And so separate it. Separate it from the book, and you have a really good movie. When you compare it to the book and everything that's missing, you're going to go, what is this experience? But it is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. They will never make a movie that expensive about teenagers with that kind of insanely operatic look to it. Edward Lockman was the DP, and the movie looks spectacular with giant crowd scenes and party scenes. No other movie from that era, not Risky Business, not Fast Times at Ridgemont High, not Valley Girl, none of them were built on as epic a scale as Less Than Zero.
I just mentioned White a few minutes ago, and it has some chapters that I'm not sure if it's okay to think of as funny, but when your very millennial boyfriend has some kind of breakdown because he doesn't think that you're woke enough, that's some sort of comedy gold.
It's a sitcom. I should have sold it. I had an agent who said, why don't you pitch this? You are the crusty Gen Xer living with the idealistic young millennial, and you're fighting all the time. There's comic gold here, he said. And I said, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. He would have a breakdown if I ever came up with this as a TV show.
But how did you get over that political crisis in your relationship?
We had a conversation. We cannot live like this. We are not going to live like this, and we are going to turn the news off. And we are going to watch the Food Network instead, which is 24 hours of chefs and baking shows and contests. And we are not going to discuss politics. And we've also become closer in terms of our disdain for politics, the media, and especially the simulacrum that has been built over our reality and
what's
has taken
simulacrum?
Over.
What's a simulacrum?
It's a fake thing. It's a fake thing.
Okay.
A thing. It's something that takes the place of something real, and it's fake. It's like propaganda in a way. And that's what happened. And we've been completely fine ever since. No more fight. Something happened, at least in the United States. I'm sure Stockholm is very different. But no one believes the media anymore in our country. Politics are so corrupted in our country. Big Pharma seems to run everything, including the government and the media. And it's just very hard to have a serious conversation with a straight face about any of this because it's all just so absurd. 90% of our population doesn't believe in the media that is given to them.
Your boyfriend is a musician.
Yes, was a very good one.
Was he into your books before you met, or did he know who you were?
He knew who I was, but he was not into my books. He had tried reading American Psycho in college and couldn't get past page 20, did not like it at all. And he knew who I was and, you know, met me at a dinner. And we just, as they say, hit it off. I thought he was really, really funny, and he thought I was really interesting, I guess.
You know, if he's into music, you've been referenced by a lot of artists like Block Party, the Manic Street Preachers, even the Misfits.
Oh, they named an album American Psycho.
My favorite Bret Easton Ellis reference in music is probably the song Obsession by Suede, where they sing about falling in love with a girl despite her many flaws. They sing, "It's the way you closed the door of my car. It's the stupid things you bought with my credit card. It's the way you don't read Camus or Bret Easton Ellis. Yeah, the TCP you use, it stings when we kiss." TCP is a type of disinfectant liquid that they use for mouthwash in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a great song, but I can kind of relate to the lyrics about not wanting to have sex with someone who's not read your books.
Not a great song either, but it's my favorite lyric that I'm in. There aren't a lot, but that's my favorite lyric that references me.
When I was at your place 25 years ago, I wrote down the names of the bands that you had in your CD rack.
No, I love CDs. I fetishize CDs. I still buy them. I buy hundreds of CDs a year. I love CDs.
The names were The Pixies, Daft Punk, Massive Attack, Wu-Tang Clan, Beastie Boys, Belle and Sebastian, The Smashing Pumpkins, and Hole. I think that was before Celebrity Skin came out, which is one of your favorite records.
Whoa, that takes me back. So those were the CDs that you noticed.
The ones you were playing, because you assured me that you had a lot of vinyl stored somewhere.
Oh, I did have a lot of vinyl stored somewhere. But I was, and I had this insanely expensive turntable that I bought that I did play the vinyl on. But that goes to show you how eclectic my tastes were. I was listening to everything. I just was, I was a musician. So I was into music and all kinds of music. The Pixies haunt me. Someone told me recently if, who's the lead singer of the Pixies?
Francis Black.
Someone said if Francis Black looked like Kurt Cobain, the Pixies would have been bigger than Nirvana.
I think Kurt Cobain would be the first to agree with that because they were his huge heroes, you know.
I'm talking about looks. How important it is for a front man to have a look. And it was because I really do think the Pixies were, in many ways, a better band than Nirvana.
Well, they were.
And they were.
If Nirvana had kept going, just releasing, less interesting albums on through the 90s and the 2000s, they would not have the same kind of iconized status that they have now.
No, I agree. And it was just so interesting when my friend said that, well, you know that if, Kurt Cobain was frontman for the Pixies, they would have been a huge band. And I was like, oh my God, he's right. They're probably right. How important that is to have that kind of look as a frontman, even now, still.
Speaking of Kurt Cobain, Courtney Love was born in the same year as you, 1964. And she, I remember she wrote somewhere, an interview magazine, when they asked celebrities to ask you questions.
Yes.
She mentioned that she almost started going to Bennington College back in 1982 because of some probation officer.
I guess so.
Who could get her into that. So she asked you if you would have wanted to be in a band with her.
And the
you,
Parents.
Of course, yes, you said yes.
So. I would have wanted her to be the lead singer of the Parents. We were like Fleetwood Mac. We had like three singers. We had a girl and we had two guys, depending on the song. And I would have wanted her, of course, to have sung all of them. And anyway, so yes, I told her that. And I've met Courtney a few times and I've hung out with her. She was dating for a long time, a very close friend of mine. So that's how I got to know her this must be 8-9 years ago.
Do you still play music from time to time?
Yeah, I don't. We just got a piano in my apartment, a small piano, because my boyfriend's a musician and he has all these instruments. He has his guitar and his piano and all this stuff. And I have not played in years and I miss it. I think if I had a bigger house, we live in a condo that's about 12 to 1400 square feet. It's not very big. It's a nice condo, but it's not very big. And I think if I lived in a house, I would definitely have like a baby grand piano because I did enjoy playing it so much. Our Lips Are Sealed by the Go-Go's is ubiquitous 80s, maybe the most famous early 80s song, maybe along with Hungry Like the Wolf by Duran Duran. I simply chose it because of how ubiquitous it is and how much it sums up that era.
It's
so good.
I love her voice, Belinda Carlisle.
So good.
I have some questions from my listeners, and not just any listeners, but the brave souls who support this podcast through Patreon. The first question is from Martin Parson. Did you get any reactions from the artists that Patrick Bateman listens to in American Psycho, and how did they feel about the book?
No, I never heard from anybody. The only time that anything happened that was strange is I was booked on an Italian TV show in 2010 for Imperial Bedrooms, that novel. And the only other guest on this Italian TV talk show that was on Sunday nights that had a viewership of like 20 million. So to be on that, you were going to sell so many fucking books. The only other guest that night, it's an hour-long show, we each had half an hour segment, was Phil Collins. And so there were two big dressing rooms in this kind of like industrial warehouse on the outskirts of Milan, or maybe it was Rome, I don't know. And since we had to get to the studio early, our people said, Phil Collins is down the hallway. Do you want us to talk to him? And I said, sure, I'll meet Phil. And so then I waited about 20 minutes, and my people came back and said, okay, well, Brett, do you want a Coke, 7-Up? I said, well, what happened to Phil? He said, he's not quite in the mood to meet you. He doesn't really want to meet you. That's it. But I've run into his daughter many times in L.A., and she said her father liked American Psycho. And, you know, he did allow, I think, them to use the studio in the film. And maybe, and a couple of other songs.
The next question is from Jesper Larsson. In 2018, you mentioned the Swedish indie artist Jens Lekman and his song Life Will See You Now on your podcast, and said that it was one of your favorite songs of the year.
No, the song was, and I remember every kiss, was the Lens?
Jens Lekman.
Okay, and I remember every kiss. It's the first track off whatever that album was. And I did love that record. And his last record was fantastic as well. It came out 2 or 3 years ago. So I have stayed with the Lens. Jens. I have stayed with Jens throughout his career. I cannot believe how he makes no money. I couldn't believe I started reading about him and how he was living in some council flat and, you know, the records weren't selling
anything. He has been touring and like performing in people's living rooms.
Yeah,
doing things like that. He did that during COVID and everything.
Yeah. Good. When he puts his mind to it, he's a really good songwriter, good pop songwriter.
One of my favorite chapters in all of your books is the fictionalized version of the Glamorama book tour in Lunar Park. Complete debauchery and descriptions of how you smoke crack and get mauled by a dog after trying to convince it to perform oral sex on a passed out fan. How much of that happened in real life?
All of it.
All of it. Okay.
All of it happened. The entire thing happened. I didn't make up anything. That was the Glamorama tour. It took 14 months. Everything happened during it. Everything happened. And I cut out a lot to make sure it was publishable. One of the most important songs for me during these years was Ice House by a band called Ice House. It was the title track of their American release. They're an Australian band. And this song haunted me in a way that no other song did during my final years of high school. And it plays a pivotal part of The Shards.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So Brett in the book thinks that the song is basically about his friends trying to find true love.
Yes.
And there's the devil inside the ice house, which yes. might be a serial killer.
Or it might be the new boy.
Yes.
The new boy that's coming in that's going to ruin Brett's friendships with his group, his tightly knit group. He is afraid that this new boy that's coming, their senior year, their final year of high school, is going to ruin everything. And in a way, Brett ruins everything. It's not really, the new kid's fault, though there's enough mystery about him to make you wonder. Anyway, so yes.
It's such a haunting song.
It is. I remember the first time I write about the first time I heard it, and I did hear it with the girl based on Susan Reynolds, and the song did speak to me in a way about what was happening, and it was like all the songs from that time, an anthem. It was an anthem, and it had a minor chord verse and then this anthemic major chord chorus, and I don't know, like all the songs from that era, I think of Split Ends, I Got You, as another song that plays that a pivotal part in the Shards. I don't know, there was a doomed romanticism about it that I just loved as a teenager.
Another thing that plays a pivotal part in the book are record store posters that the killer seems to have left behind at people's places as a sign that it's the first murder and the second and the third, yeah. And then there's a Gang of Four poster.
Yeah.
Did you check out those posters before you wrote it, or did you just pick a few bands with the numbers and their names? Or
I just was thinking of bands with numbers and their names. At one point, U2 was going to be the second murder card. It's a card the serial killer leaves, a warning to yes. the victim that the victim doesn't know. But Three Imaginary Boys by The Cure, I didn't even know that was their first record. All I knew was that record, and I used that. And Second Edition by Public Image Limited, I used for the second murder. Foreigner 4. Was one, and there were various other ones that were used.
You too have played an interesting role in a few of your books, because Patrick Bateman gets an erection when he sees Bono for some reason. He doesn't like the music, but he's attracted to him.
Just like me. I always got an erection whenever I saw Bono.
Really?
No, I'm
no,
kidding.
Okay.
No, Bono was not my type. Look, there was a period when I loved U2. I actually loved U2 after I published American Psycho, because Octum Baby is, I believe, their greatest record. So, and that came out a year after American Psycho had come out. I think I might have changed. There's a scene in American Psycho where Patrick and his friends go see U2 on the Joshua tour, and he's just Patrick Bateman thinks there's something wrong with Bono. He has a connection to him. He says he's just like him. He is evil as well. He is capable of evil. Do you know that I had to cut that paragraph from the UK edition of American Psycho?
Why?
It is not in libel laws. My publisher was afraid of libel laws that I was calling.
Bono would have loved that.
Loved it, I know, because he played Mephistopheles.
Yes, he did. He was wearing like horns as the devil.
It was so absurd that I couldn't believe that I had to cut that one paragraph. But maybe they reinstated it. Maybe they put it back in later versions. I don't know.
And then U2, of course, returns in Glamorama, where like the phrase will slip down the surface of things.
Which is from Autumn Baby album.
Yes, yeah. And it appears all through the book.
It was really impactful. I really loved that record. And that record was such a key record of the early 90s when I began writing Glamorama that it was like, it was my soundtrack. Nearly perfect record.
HBO is interested in turning The Shards into a TV series. How do you think that will turn out? And will you write it, of course?
Well, how do I think it will turn out? It is in development at HBO. So this means HBO has optioned it. So they now control the rights for a while, and we are now developing it into a TV show. Yes, part of the deal was I'm going to write every episode. Part of the deal was it's going to be 30 episodes, which means three seasons. And we are now in negotiations with Luca Guadagnino. I'm totally mangling his name as the front director that we all want. So I don't know. How will it go? I was working in TV for about 15 years in development, and I wrote many, many, many scripts, and nothing got made. So I am now kind of, you know, jaded about it. I'm working on the notes that I just got from HBO on the pilot that I completed really quite quickly after the writer's strike in America ended. There was a big writer's strike in America. You people in Stockholm don't need to know about it, but writers couldn't work for 3 to 4 months because of the strike and the unions and all this nonsense. So yes, we are working right now on trying to get that first episode right. And I'm writing all the episodes.
Looking back, which of the movie adaptations of your books are you the happiest with?
Rules of Attraction. Rules of Attraction by Roger Avery, which came out in 2002 and was really only allowed to be made because in 2000, the same studio had released American Psycho. And they had done some business. It wasn't a great hit, but it did enough that, let's do another Bret Easton Ellis novel, and that's how The Rule of Attraction got greenlit, because you watch it now and you go, how in the hell did this get made? Oh my God. It's the raunchiest, darkest teen college comedy, I guess you'd call it, ever made, I'd say. Mainstream, from a mainstream studio. It is the most faithful stylistically and tonally to any of my books. American Psycho is a very, very different beast as a book compared to a movie. Less Than Zero has no connection to the movie. The Rules of Attraction really does. It really captured the spirit of it. And I love that movie. I just think it's great. In fact, I let Roger Avery buy the rights to Glamorama, which he was going to make right after The Rules of Attraction. And that was a bad deal. I shouldn't have done it because he still owns the rights.
I was watching scenes from that movie last night, and it's, you know, it's so funny when one guy overdoses and his friends bring him to ER, and there's a doctor who's just tired of college kids, so he goes, "Oh, you don't have any pulse, you're dead." Yep. And he says, "But I'm alive." "No, no, no, you're absolutely dead." And he's played by Paul Williams, the LA legend who was on Daft Punk's last album,
Phantom of the Paradise. Yes. Paul Williams. He plays Swan, a movie that I watch every week.
And he says, "It's toe tag time in Teenville tonight."
What a great line! I wish I'd written that line. Roger wrote that line. That line is not in the book.
Also, that movie has a great movie poster with the cuddly toys having sex.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of them. There's a couple of great posters. They could not use that one in the United States, so that was only used in some parts of Europe. There's a really cool one that I have actually in my apartment that's more mainstream, kind of more minimal, cooler and sexier, and that is the one they used in the United States.
Did you see the Finnish poster?
No, what was the Finnish poster?
They translated the title, and it has a... I think it's a great title. It's so stupid that it goes all the way around. The Rules of Attraction, the Finnish translation is Fuck the Rules.
Well, you know, in Japan, when Less Than Zero was released in Japan, the title was It's Raining Blood and Cocaine in Beverly Hills. So, you know,
like it's cloudy with the chance of meatballs.
So, you know, language, movie titles are change all over the world into sometimes ridiculous things. I'm really surprised that the shards is a very difficult word to translate in so many territories. Splinters is one thing. I don't know what's it called here?
Skärvorna. That's shards. That's pretty exact.
It's pretty exact. There. Okay. But yes, that is funny about titles, movie titles, yes.
I remember in one old interview, you were complaining about how the French translation of Glamorama...
Complaining? I was complaining. I used to, I guess.
Well, you were upset because the French translator thought that, you know, when it started to smell shit... everywhere. Victor in the book, you know, everything smells like feces, you know, it smells like shit. The French translator thought that you meant weed, like marijuana.
Because
in French, when you yeah. smoke, you say fumé du shit, you smoke okay. weed. So you were
really, I like that.
So, but
like
but that. Now it's interesting because if you go to New York, at least as a European, everything smells like marijuana. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah, no, I know.
You know,
I like that.
Mistranslation kind of became reality.
I was a bit of a nihilist then, and I did like this idea that the deeper Victor Ward got into this world of fashion and terrorism, that he was smelling excrement, that it was this odor was permeating rooms he was in, and clouds of it were everywhere. I like the weed version better, which is why I never reread my books, because all I want to do now is take a pen and I want to change the shit to weed. Well, Frederick, thank you for having me. This is a busy day. This is now, I guess, a Tuesday morning, and I was happily pleased to be on your podcast.
I'm so happy that I'm about to explode, so let's just stop right now. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you. I was so hard to please. Look around.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Lejon Media. Brett Easton Ellis var hemma hos Drage.